Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Hello and welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com, and this is a new edition of Training and Tactics Talk. This show will talk about truck company operations, and we have a nice diverse group of firefighters and fire officers from across the country on this show. Thank you for the feedback on the last few shows. Really appreciate it. If you do have any comments or questions for the presenters or our guests, please do feel free to send us an email to podcast@firehouse.com. And if you'd like to be a part of an upcoming show, please let us know as well. We'd like to have some other folks on when possible. Today we have several veteran firefighters from truck companies across the country. We have Mike Dugan, a captain with the FDNY's Ladder 123. Rod Ford, who's a volunteer firefighter with the Glenwood Fire Company in Glenwood Landing, New York. He's also a New York City firefighter assigned to a truck company in Queens. Dave Gallagher is a retired lieutenant with the Huber Heights, Ohio Fire Department. And Wes Kitchell is a captain from the Santa Rosa Fire Department in California. All right, guys, just going to go around real quick, and if you want to throw in any more information about yourself, feel free. And also, if you could just tell us a little bit about your department's ladder companies. You know, how many companies do you have? What types of apparatus do you have? How many truck companies are assigned to the first alarm? And what's your department staffing on a truck company? We'll start with Mike.
Okay, hi. Good morning, and thank you, Pete. My name is Mike Dugan, as Pete said, and I'm a captain in the New York City Fire Department. Our truck companies, we have 168, I think, truck companies in the city of New York. We also have the rescues, which are almost like a super truck and some squads. And our manning is an officer and five firefighters. And on a first alarm assignment, we will get two trucks for work. One is a rapid intervention team. We will get a rescue and a squad. So we really have four working truck companies there and one standing by as our rapid intervention team.
Okay, and you operate a mix of tower ladders and rear mounts, tillers?
Tower ladders, rear mounts, tillers. We have just about everything. We have a few 95-foot towers. Most of our towers are 75-foot. We have most of our rigs are rear mount straight sticks, and we have in some of our smaller streeted neighborhoods, areas that are very, very difficult, we have some tiller rigs. We have a few, I think we have nine tiller rigs in New York City.
Okay. All right. Wes Kitchell from Santa Rosa, can you tell us a little bit about your department?
Sure. My name's Wes Kitchell. Thanks for having me. We have, we're considered a medium-sized department out here on the West Coast. We have nine engines, two truck companies. Both trucks are tractor-drawn aerials, tillers, with an officer and three, which out here in a department our size is a premium staffing. Usually it's an officer and two. On the first alarm, we'll get three engines and a truck. If it goes to a work and fire assignment, it ups to a fourth engine, and then additional alarms are all three in one with chief officers on each alarm. Basically, our truck companies do the rescue, ventilation, utilities, all those types of things on the fire ground to support the engine company's mission at getting water on the seat of the fire. And since we're the largest career department in our area, we have the only staff truck company, so we do mutual aid to a lot of surrounding communities and the like that are all pretty much bedroom communities to the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area.
Okay. Rod Ford.
How are you guys? My name is Rod Ford. I'm with the Glenwood Volunteer Fire Company in Nassau County, Long Island. Been there for 10 years. Served as lieutenant for four. Our truck companies, we have two trucks that we run as trucks. One is a 93-foot ladder tower, and the other is a 75-foot Quint. Our staffing depends on who comes out. We don't man the firehouses in shifts. We all carry pagers. When the pager goes off, we respond to the firehouse. So depending upon the time of day, the time of night, our staffing is going to change. That's one of our biggest unknowns that we have to overcome on the fire ground, how many guys we're getting and who we're getting. And as for our truck companies, they'll perform normal truck company operations, forcible entry, overhaul, search, laddering the building, ventilation, salvage. So we're pretty much a standard truck company, but we are limited sometimes by the number of people that we can get.
Okay. And Dave Gallagher, can you tell us a little bit about your department there in Huber Heights?
Good day. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Huber Heights Fire Division was a 50-person career department, two stations in the north suburb of Dayton, Ohio. Very similar to Wes and Rod's situation in that we were one of the very few fully staffed departments on the north side of Dayton. We ran a lot of automatic mutual aid response, including into the city of Dayton. My ladder company was first due at times to five other jurisdictions besides our own. 105-foot rear mount. It was equipped with a pump, but I don't even... I think it fought one car fire in its history, but we were a dedicated truck company. What we were handcuffed by, same as Rod and Wes, was staffing. We ran Firebase EMS, and if the medic units were out, that obviously depleted the available personnel. Usually, we were running three, many times two, to these incidents and still responsible for all the normal truck functions on the fire ground. We tried to have some unique ways of dealing with those, but that part of the country around the greater Dayton area and such, I also ran part-time and volunteer in a couple places with some ladders, and it was very much the same situation.
Okay. You know, the basic truck company operations include ventilation, searching for life and fire, and forcible entry. You know, some departments equip their ladder companies with hydraulic rescue tools or, you know, confined space tools or something on that special operations end. Do your departments utilize truck companies for that kind of stuff? And Dave, we'll start with you on this one. Obviously, you're also an EMS agency, so you're running EMS.
Right. One of the things the Dayton area did rather aggressively was split the responsibilities for the various disciplines of technical rescue. Amongst many departments, there was a primary department, safer water rescue, and then a support agency in case the primary department was tied up on an incident of their own. Huber was primary for high angle, so our ladder company had all the high angle equipment on board as far as any technical rescue issues.
Okay, Mike, how about ladder 123 and your maybe surrounding companies in Brooklyn?
Well, we have something in New York City called SOC support trucks, which we are not one of them, but the trucks are equipped to back up the rescues in technical rescue. They have to go through the same training that the firefighters in rescue go through, and they are equipped with a second piece. We also equip a lot of our tower ladders. They're pretty much exclusively tower ladders now. That's what they're assigning as CPC, chemical protective units, with the chemical protective clothing, and the CPC trucks are there to work with engines, and they become a decon task force for WMD. So some of our trucks are equipped with specialized equipment. All of our trucks don't have as much heavy rescue. Each truck has a hearse tool on it. We'll have airbags and things like that for basics. We're still going to call a rescue and a squad to get the additional tools there that they carry, the specialized tools.
Okay. Wes Kitchell.
Our trucks are jack-of-all-trades. We do run fire-based EMS as well. We have ALS engine companies and BLS trucks. Our trucks, we never had a rescue company, either unstaffed or staffed in our department or area. So our trucks have hydraulic rescue tools, full complement of rope gear, airbags, all the forcible entry tools. Everything heavy is on those trucks because we had to do it all. We now have a heavy rescue that is unstaffed, but cross-staffed by either the truck company or the engine company downtown in our headquarters station, as well as being part of the hazardous materials response team where hazmat techs. So we basically have, if it's any kind of a technical call, hazmat, rescue, anything like that, our truck companies are going to respond, either one or both of them, depending on where it is in town, and be responsible for all of the technical equipment that would be used at one of those incidents. And with that, again, in that regional response, our heavy rescue is a center point, heavy resource from San Francisco to the Oregon border. So we could potentially, if there was an earthquake in the northern part of the state, be moving our resources up there as initial responders to work with the locals. So we have quite a diverse responsibility besides going to fires in our particular area.
Okay, and Rod Ford from Glenwood.
Our ladder tower is strictly used as a truck. We don't have any special operations capabilities. All our special operations capabilities, all that equipment is on our heavy rescue truck. Our truck just, we have ladders, hand tools, salvage equipment, ventilation fans, power saws, just the basics. Anything beyond that is carried on our heavy rescue truck. And then our other Quint is the same, except that we have, you know, obviously the hoses and some engine engine devices on there. So we're
okay.
The basic truck.
And as officers, how do you find a time to, you know, make sure that you're up and trained on everything? You know, Wes, it sounds like you're a USAR team packed into a ladder company. So, you know, I mean, how do you manage training, whether it's truck company operations and then, you know, making sure that you refresh on engine company operations and then do your EMS training, do your hazmat training and all that stuff? How do you manage to make sure you have enough time to check on everything?
We have a pretty busy training schedule, as you might imagine. We have specific blocks of time in a month laid out for hazmat and technical rescue. Then we have a prescriptive training regimen from our training division that deals with engine and truck company operations and just rotating through different topics each month. And going out to our training center, you know, pulling lines, working together, multi-company drills, things like that. We spend a good amount of time doing the training in between the calls. But, you know, it's like anything else. It's wearing so many hats. You try and be as good as you can in the things that are the most important. And those usually are the ones that are the most common because that's what you're doing the most. But still, with the mentality that you need to maintain the lesser used skills, which are probably the ones that are going to get you in trouble the most. So it's difficult at best. You have a lot of balls in the air all at once.
Okay, anybody else have any thoughts to that, the training issues?
Well, I agree 100% with Wes. It's difficult. Our operation, we wound up cross-staffing. First call of the day may be EMS, second one may be a car fire, third one may be a structure response, and everybody's bouncing back and forth across the different apparatus. The only thing, our training was very similar to Wes's, but the one thing we tried to do at the company level whenever we could was take a Saturday or Sunday when something wasn't on the regular calendar and try to go out and get some sort of company drill, and particularly if you saw a flaw or a sluggish point on a call and you wanted to work on improving the skills that were involved in that, either with veteran firefighters or if you had somebody new on board.
Okay.
I also, I go into work and I ask the men, what do we need to drill on? And a lot of times the senior men will come and say, hey, Cap, you know, we had a problem at a, something didn't go as good as we would like at a fire, so why don't we practice on this? And we schedule multi-unit drill, which is companies in the surrounding area. Ours is every Sunday, and that's scheduled, and we go out every Sunday morning for an hour and a half to 2 hours with our local companies. And we also drill once for an hour every day tour and once for an hour every night tour. And we still drill all the time. I mean, you go in and the guys ask you, hey, did you see this? Or did you read that? What about this? And I think as officers, and I hope the other officers here will agree with me, Dave, Wes, Rod, everybody, when we go out and train, you set, as an officer, you set the tone. And you'll go into a lot of places and see the guy saying, hey, listen, did you see this? Let's try this. Can we work on this? And there's nothing better as an officer than seeing your guys want to train.
That's very good points. You know, if they're not willing to do it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with Mike more on that. You know, as an officer, definitely. You do set the tone.
Okay.
Just to add my two cents in from the volunteer side, it's sometimes difficult to have standardized training and get everybody up to the same level. Just with my volunteer department, it's tough. A lot of guys are working two jobs. They have a lot of things going on at home. So they don't always have the time to come down on our drills, which are either on a Sunday or a Wednesday. So sometimes guys, they can only get down to the firehouse to drill once or twice a week. Oh, I'm sorry, once or twice a month. And we try to focus those drills on the basics, stretching hose lines, laddering a building, trying to get guys into any type of special operations training is very difficult. That training is time-consuming, and unfortunately, the volunteers, a lot of people just don't have that time. So what they've done in Nassau County, some of the other volunteer fire departments have had a number of people that are interested in that training, and they kind of work as a regional team in Nassau County. And we also have Nassau County Police Department, ESU, if we need any technical rescue or high-angle rescue, special operations capability, we can use them. But for our training and the volunteers, we really just try to focus on the basics, engine and truck work.
All right. We'll break into a scenario here, kind of what would you do, and I'll read off the blurb here and then give you a couple questions, and we'll go through and everybody can kind of tell me what they're thinking, what they would go based upon their department's SOPs or, you know, your mindset when you arrive. You'll be the engine company of your, I'm sorry, you'll be the officer of your truck company, so use your normal staffing or what you would hope to be your normal staffing for this night. You arrive first due at 2:37 in the morning to find a two-story wood frame house on fire. You do a quick size-up, and it shows you got heavy fire showing from three windows on the second floor, two on side A, one on side B, and heavy smoke is issuing from the other windows on the second floor, and the gable vents as well. It appears that the attic may be involved. The mother is frantic, telling you her two children are upstairs, but you're unable to get an exact location of their rooms. The first new engine is at least a minute out to 2 minutes out. As you force the door, smoke is banked down to the floor, and it's very thick, dark black smoke. Couple questions for everybody here. Would you enter the structure and begin searches knowing that you're at least 2 minutes from having a hose line placed in operation? And that's 2 minutes is hopefully a very quick number for them to at least get the line flaked out and charged. If you choose to enter the structure without a hose line, do you access the second floor stairway by stairway or by ladders from the outside? And what are you looking for where you begin your searches? Once you're inside, it's obvious that you have heavy fire conditions on the second floor. Looks like to be in the attic, and that there's some involvement with the structure itself. What signs are you looking for to withdraw your crew? And last, would you split your crew to different areas to do a search? And we'll start with Rod Ford on this one from the volunteer end of it.
Okay. Our normal staffing at that time, hopefully, would be a chauffeur, the officer, and two guys on the back. Again, our actions initially are going to be dictated by the experience of the crew on the back, and for that matter, all four of us. If it's four experienced guys, we may be a little more aggressive in our actions. If it's four very junior personnel, then we may have to be less aggressive. That's one of the problems in the volunteers. Just so we don't get the experience. Fortunately, we live in a community that's not burning down. And some of our guys just don't have a whole lot of fire experience. And as an officer, you're responsible for them. So you don't want to be too too aggressive and getting anybody hurt. Based on what you're telling me, it sounds like we have a very good fire. Pull up. First thing you want to do is your size up. Check the basement. Around here, we have a lot of older balloon frame construction buildings. Heavy smoke on the first floor, fire up on the second floor. That's one of my first thoughts. Check the basement. If I find out that there's no fire in the basement, then it comes a decision, you know, do we try to make the stairs up to the second floor, or do we try to VES from the outside with no hose line? The fire's already vented itself, so it's a tough call. If you look and you see maybe there's some top finder stickers, something like that, maybe I'd want to go that route, VESing from the outside. Without any indications of where the children may be from the outside, I think our best bet in that case would be force the front door, tie off a search line, and try to get up to the second floor using the thermal imaging camera and the off the search rope. Search rope is a lot easier said than done. I think anybody who's ever trained with or used a search rope knows that it's a slow, methodical process. It's not as quick as it seems. I think I would split the team into two. As the officer, I would take the most experienced of the firefighters. We would go in. I would leave probably the third guy. I would leave him at the ground, the ground floor, near the front door, near the base of the stairs, wherever we tied the search rope off of, just as a point of reference, point of orientation, in case we were to get lost up on the second floor. I would let the incoming engine know that the two members are going in to perform a search, and I would also try to get those two guys left on the outside, try to get them with a 24-foot portable ladder outside, just in case we did get up to the second floor, got lost, and found our way to a window. We'd have somebody outside with a 24-foot to rather quickly set the ladder up to the window and hopefully get us down. But that's, again, you're going on, you're weighing the risk versus reward with the life hazard up on the second floor. So it's assuming it's on the second floor. Most of the private dwellings around here, the bedrooms are on the second floor. So it's that's a tough situation. But that would be that would probably most likely be what we would do. And then once the engine company got on scene, we would pull out, inform the engine company where the fire was, and then go in and continue to search off the hand line once the engine company puts the fire out. So.
All right, cool. Wes Kitchell, what would you guys do in Santa Rosa?
Well, the way our operations are set up is we actually have a standard operating procedure for a known rescue where we split the crew. This one being the way it is, there's going to be a lot of emotion, obviously, with the mother jumping around outside and everything, and the fact that we're looking at this building trying to determine if there's anything, any survivable areas in it at all. And that's not to say that we're not going to do the same thing, but it starts to add a curveball to the normal operation. What we would probably do is split into two. Two of us, the normal vent crew, would go based on construction, because we have a mishmash of different types of construction out here. Would assess the ventilation need of the building, while the other two more experienced firefighters would set up to make entry and look at the entry point door and a couple of things there. If they're going to force the door, one of the things we talk about and train on is what's the smoke going to do? What's it doing? If you force the door and it's black to the floor and it's just sitting there doing nothing, you might have just a static smoke situation. If it all of a sudden takes a big, deep breath, you have pretty dynamic fire activity and things are going to change rapidly. You may have just caused the change by forcing that door. Our thought is the best way we can support the rescue and the safety of those people is to open the building up as much as we can. We do a lot of vertical ventilation because we can. Our area that we operate in is one- and two-story structures. We have a lot of garden apartments, two- and three-story townhouse-type construction for those, all wood frame. very little masonry, some balloon frame, but mostly it's platform construction. We have a lot of truss. You know, everything's built out of trusses. They're even using sheet metal trusses for roof structures out here now. Not to mention tile roofs is a big deal in California, and they weigh anywhere from 7 to 15 pounds a piece. So you have a real heavy load on these roofs, so the failure issue is a big deal. The fact that you've got so much active smoke pushing says the building's not vented properly. You've got fire showing out the windows, but they could get up there and the second floor could just go because of the oxygen they put in. So we're going to open the building up, bottom line. That's the best thing we can do. The rescue crew would tie off with a search rope, take their ticks, start up to the second floor because, again, as Rod said, out here the mass is the mass of the fire's occupants, or the fires that we would have in our occupancies, the living areas at night are up on the second floor. We have no basements. So if it's not a first-floor fire that's easily visible and it's showing on the second, we just go with the fact that it's on the second floor. They'd go up, do as much of a uniform search as they could, communicating via radio to the inbound units of where their location is, what they're doing, what they need, while we're up on the roof trying to open this place up. Again, it's a risk-benefit. If there's early structural, you know, it looks like it's going to collapse, the roof's involved, you got sag, pronounced sag because of tile up on the roof, that's going to change things considerably. And we just may opt not to go in there because of the structural integrity of the building. There's no sense in burying two other guys up there with the in a pile of rubble for something that we couldn't save anyway.
All right, Mike Dugan, FDNY.
FDNY, well, we have our standard operating procedures for the truck company is at the beginning of each tour, each man is assigned a position, and the positions they have, they are trained in, and those positions would be the roof firefighter, and at a 2.5-story frame, we're not going to go vent the roof initially, we're going to go for the life hazard, an OVM, which is our outside vent man, to do our horizontal ventilation. We have an irons firefighter who carries the irons, who's going to go in on the search with the officer, a can man who brings 2.5 gallons of pressurized water with him. In a situation like this, depending on where the fire is, if it's on the first floor or the basement, because we do have the basements, we would check the basement. If we know the fire's on the second floor, then we're going to go to the second floor with the irons and the can firefighter and try to confine that fire, and give our OV on our roof and the chauffeur who's driving the rig, the three of them are going to have portable ladders and be trying to go in windows and make the rescue, if possible. And again, as Wes said, building construction. If it's a lightweight truss building, we might say the fire is into, it involves the structure now. It's no longer a room and contents fire. And then it's a defensive operation. You know, we didn't start the fire. We didn't cause the fire. We're there to try to help, but we got to help within the benefits, within the confines of our people, to make sure that we protect our people and keep them alive. We showed up alive. We don't know if this child trapped in there is even alive at the present time. So we have to make sure that we keep our people's safety as our number one thing, our number one priority. But we are always, I'm always going to split my crew. That's just the way our SOPs are written.
All right. Dave Gallagher.
Well, this is something we would probably be responding, and I'm going to go that maybe we've had a good night with a three-member crew. And a lot of what the previous, Wes, Rod, and Mike have already said, all pertain particularly building construction. A lot of it's a gut check at the front yard. Hey, what are we really looking at? And one thing, if I was the officer, I would try to do very quickly, just get around to the seaside and take a look and see if I've got maybe one of the kids in the back hanging out the back window or something like that. What worked well for us in the burbs, we had riding assignments as well, and they would fluctuate depending upon our staffing. But the bottom three, obviously the driver, the officer, and the jump seat member behind the officer, there were tools assigned. And the one thing we did, and we picked that up from a good friend of mine, Bobby Swick in Fairborn, Ohio, where he was responsible for a one-man ladder company for a long time, was a ladder pack where the driver would basically lay on the ground a 16-foot roof ladder, a 24-foot extension, a 6-foot hook and irons, and pick up one end of that assembly and drag it to the rear so we could put something into play if we did indeed have a civilian hanging out the back window. In our situation, I don't know that we wouldn't pursue that as well, particularly at the CB corner. And we've got a good vent coming out the windows on the second floor, and our driver could take a quick look into that second floor window. And also taking a look on the size up, you know, do we see the kids' curtains? Do we see stuff in their window, sun catchers, all that that may dictate like where a child may be? And those are the things we had to look at to give it our best shot, like I said, particularly with limited staffing. I think we would probably take the VES route, particularly with the driver, and let the, after the officer did a walk around, the officer and the jump seat individual size up whether we had a basement incident. And again, on the size up, in our jurisdiction, you would see the basement well windows, and, you know, definitely pop one of those and take a look. You know, I got smoke and fire coming out. Do I have a basement involvement? West Rod and Mike are all right. That kind of changes things a lot, particularly in a balloon frame. But we would definitely be splitting our crew, but with a significant degree of accountability. I knew where the driver was going to be. He had a specific assignment, and he wasn't freelancing. And it was up to him to communicate as quickly as possible what he found, as well as the officer and jump seat to the arriving crews and what they perceived that the next step should be and what the needs would be.
Okay. All right, guys, we'll take a quick break here, and we'll be back right here in a minute on radio@firehouse.com.
Radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to radio@firehouse.com. This is Training and Tactics Talk, and this show is about truck company operations, in case you missed the first half. During a commercial break, one of the things that was mentioned was the experience and possible lack thereof with so many new firefighters over the last couple of years being appointed. Obviously, New York City Fire Department has seen a huge turnaround since 9/11. And Wes just brought up that truck companies were only created in Santa Rosa in 1986. You know, growing up on the East Coast, you would always hear that, you know, you go to an engine company, and then after a couple of years, you get your experience, and you go to a truck company. And with fires being down across the country, who was that?
I have no idea.
I'm not sure.
Did somebody just dial in?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. All right, well, we'll start from the beginning on that then. Wes, that was 1986, right?
Actually, it was 85, if I was thinking 85. About it.
Yeah. Okay, all right. Also, I'll just say the mid-80s.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Welcome back to Training and Tactics Talk here on radio@firehouse.com. This show is about truck company operations, in case you weren't paying attention through the first half an hour here. During a commercial break, we all had the chance to talk a little bit about some things going on, some trends that people are seeing and whatnot, and brought up the fact that there's so many new firefighters. New York City has obviously seen a turnaround since 9/11, and even Wes just brought up the fact that truck companies were only brought to life in the mid-1980s in Santa Rosa. So, having grown up on the East Coast, you would always hear a firefighter assigned to an engine company to get some fire experience, and then they would make their way to a truck company, and then eventually, if there was room, they could go to a special operations company. What have you guys seen as a trend, you know, with the decreased amount of fires, younger firefighters, what have you guys seen so far in the last few years as to operations and experience or lack of experience?
I think the one thing that kind of scares me is these young firefighters become young officers without much experience either. And I think we can train the firefighters, I think, a heck of a lot easier than you can train company officers on decision making and recognizing conditions. And, you know, you can't buy experience, but I think those are some issues. Suddenly you're thrust into a leadership role with maybe not a lot of experience. experience or training for that specific role. I know that happens in small departments frequently. There's no officer courses or anything like that. And you got to kind of fly by the seat of your pants, which can be very, very hazardous to the entire situation. But that's, to me, has been one common thread. We see a lot of people with lieutenant or captain on their helmets, and you realize that they've never been given the opportunity to know what to do. And you know, in the truck side of things, there's a little bit more more dynamics going on, I guess I should say. I think it would behoove us to try to pay attention to that aspect of it.
I think there's also an issue, and New York City has gotten a lot younger after 9/11, but everywhere is getting younger.
Mm-hmm.
Fire service is cyclical. It goes in cycles. We hired a lot as communities grew, and now those people are getting to the retirement age, and they're retiring. We're retiring as a society younger to try to enjoy our retirement. But the thing that I see about this, all of this, is that it reinforces the necessity for training, whether it's young firefighters, young officers. We're definitely not doing the same amount of fire duty that we did in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, even the 90s. So we now have to go back to our training and make sure that that training schedule that your department is putting together is progressive, proactive, and is working to train your firefighters and train them to be good firefighters and then in turn be good officers.
I agree with that. I agree with what Mike said. One of the things that I think the training program needs to incorporate, too, is experiences that they don't get. And if you remember, you know, in the 80s, 70s, 60s, guys came out of the trades into the fire department. They had some type of life experience. They had some tool knowledge. They had, you know, construction background, whatever. The new people nowadays are more technically oriented. The internet, you know, electronic gadgets, things like that. They're not manipulative people. So the training is very important to ground them in what the craft of firefighting is, but you even have to train them in things that ordinarily they would have had years ago. You now have to put those into academies. So when you call for a tool or you talk about a type of construction or how to take something apart, they have a basis to work off of that they can try and broaden or deepen their experience level. And that's been a real challenge. Is to try and get that attitude to change towards where those things are important, which were never important in their life as they grew up. Somebody else did the work around their house. Their dads never did. They never did. Those types of things are what is a real challenge for us that we're finding, which takes away from their ability to grasp a lot of the basics.
I have to agree with everything everybody said, especially what Captain Dugan was talking about. The lack of fire duty and the lack of experience just reinforces the need for training. Unfortunately, you can't just go out and get experience. You're either going to make the fire or you're not. It's something you really can't do anything about. But training, you can do something about. You can conscientiously make an effort to make, as a volunteer, to make all the drills. To, in your spare time, pick up a book, do some reading on firefighting. It's a difficult thing in the volunteer fire service. In this day and age, everybody's working two jobs, and people just don't have the time to really put forth a lot of effort into the training. So it's a definite difficulty within the volunteer fire service.
I know the one thing Wes had identified in his operation, and I know the FDNY has, and my couple departments I've been with have tried it, is the SOPs. Wes was even talking about SOPs for doing a search, you know, criteria. What do you need? What are you looking for? A tactical approach to that. And I think that's excellent as well. If we have some things to fall back on, where we can train people on SOPs and to recognize that and start to think, then we can work on the practical training as far as, you know, getting them up on the ladder, getting them in a window, knocking out a primary smart search in a low visibility area. But having things that are solid, like these guys have to pull back on, I think is going to be superb. And like Mike was saying, it is cyclic. and we need to have sort of, I guess for lack of a better term, a safety net so that these people have some known support going in to the operations and into the philosophy of the organization.
One of the, if I may, one of the things that we have that we developed early on, and it was a very much a battle inside our department, were company standards. So that if you're on an engine, no matter where you are in town, and you go to a fire, everybody puts the line in service the same way. We have 24 engine company standards for structural and wildland firefighting. We have 14 for truck companies. And it's the gambit, single-family dwelling, commercial occupancy, over-the-side rescue, high-angle rescue, confined space, you know, different things. But it's everybody does it the same way, so if, it doesn't matter if you're working on the D shift, they do it the same way as the A shift, and vice versa. And Engine 1 and Engine 7 do it the same way. And that's been real helpful in providing a basic level of training, because now you don't have, you know, 27 fire departments out there and everything's different depending on the officer. Everybody has to follow the same sheet of music, which has really been helpful in the training and keeping people focused on what their job skills are and the description of what they're responsible for based on where they ride or what piece they're on.
All right, guys, we'll get into our last topic for the show, ventilation. You know, for the last couple of years, probably 10 years at least, the debate about positive pressure ventilation has been going on. And I know some departments use it, some departments use it at certain times. You know, we've all seen incidents or pictures from an incident where it just it goes wrong and the fire travels where it wasn't supposed to go, and sometimes the fans help out. I guess we'll go around and just kind of get everybody's thoughts and what do you guys believe if you do use the positive pressure ventilation. If not, maybe the reasons why you don't do it. Dave, we'll start with you on this one.
Well, in our operation, and I wish I could fall back to what Wes was just talking about, there were a wide variety of opinions depending upon what one person read or one person experienced or what class that a person had went to. And when I had left my job, there didn't seem to be a consensus opinion. Unfortunately, at times there were different people wanted to do different things, and we didn't have, well, if you go to the single-family dwelling, then this is what goes on type of thing to that degree, down to a task-based level. They're working on that, and I hope that they've had the ability to get that improved. The fan, however, was a huge controversy, a huge topic. It was the latest, greatest thing at the time when our department was introduced into it, I think probably mid-late 80s. And it was used indiscriminately, and I have to say, while we never burned a place down that I could say because of that, it was obviously we needed some more education. I feel strongly that a grassroots consensus was if we had a fire that was compartmentalized, not out of the compartment of origin, a bedroom, a kitchen, and had not extended into unknown areas, was an unknown quantity, kind of like when you're dealing with a 2.5 and using the ADULTS acronym, if we didn't know pretty well where the fire was, we wouldn't use the fan. If we knew it was isolated, it was a one-shot deal, you know, kid lit the bed off, we can pop the window, shut the door, you know, gain control that way, whatever, we would use the fan. Had it got out of the compartment vertically or horizontally, then we would be we wouldn't use the fan probably as indiscriminately. We would top floor fire, we'd rely on a vertical vent. We had a significant amount of one-story single-family dwellings, horizontal ventilation. If we had it coming out more for windows, helped us out quite a bit. In certain cases, we could use the fan, but again, that was a field choice that was probably based more on experience than it would be on SOPs and what the incident commander wanted to see at that time.
All right, Wes, what do you guys do in Santa Rosa, or, you know, what have you been training on?
We use fans pretty extensively. We use them in combination with our vertical ventilation to enhance the air movement out the vent hole. We'll use them for attack under certain conditions. I can't agree with Dave more that a lot of it has to deal with the type of construction, and we have all kinds of different types of construction out here, from balloon frame to ultra lightweight curtain construction for high rise, all that type of thing. So you really got to weigh the pluses and the minuses of what the building's given you as to whether you're going to apply the fans. There are certain criteria that we won't use it. We won't use them in a Victorian, a balloon frame building, because obviously the air is going to enhance the fire travel. We won't use them in certain single-family dwellings or multiple occupancy dwellings, depending on what the attic's doing and what the ability for us to exhaust the air that we're pushing in there. And that's another part of it. If you can't get an exhaust opening big enough, don't be pushing air in there, because you're going to bring the fire right back to the point that you're entering in. So there's a number of criteria to using the fans. We always stage them at the front door. That's part of the process that we go through. Those fans are brought to the front door as much as the initial attack line, and they're left there. Are they always started? Not always. We sometimes wait until we're a little bit into the incident to see what the fire is going to do before we'll start the fans. One of the things that happens out here a lot is positive pressure attack. It usually happens in departments where truck companies aren't an option. The engines carry blowers. The basic tactic is the fire is compartmentalized. The construction is going to keep it in that compartment. They can create a good exit opening. They fire the fan up after the exit opening is made. Wait about 15, 20 seconds for that cone of air to start pushing the fire out. Make sure there's no detrimental fire changes. That the place doesn't, you know, flash over, things like that, and then they'll take their hose line and follow that cone of air into the seat of the fire and put it out. It works. It doesn't work in every situation. Some people say, oh, it's always that way. No, you can't say, never say never, never say always in the fire service, because something's always going to be a twist. But it's a tool like any other tool. It may be the easiest for that quick knockdown, rather than waiting until somebody has to get there and do some other type of conventional ventilation. But we find that it works very well. The thing that we are very cautious on for people is tell them not to get too aggressive on setting the fan up, you know, for an attack and then go in, because you may cause the change that you most don't want to have happen by that cone of air. And then obviously if it's a situation where it's close to backdraft, you know, at that transitional point between the two phases of fire, we don't use them at all, because we are going to bring a problem to the process. But we use fans quite extensively. They have their place. They've worked well for us. And again, it all comes down to training, the building construction knowledge, fire behavior knowledge, and how those two things and the fans are going to react in any kind of an environment that you put them into.
Okay. Mike Dugan, New York City.
New York City right now is in a pilot program to use the fans in high-rise spaces to pressurize the stairwells. We do not use them in our basic fire attack. Number one, most of our buildings in New York City are extremely large and very old. Most of our normal buildings are 70, 80 to 100, some of them older than that. So renovations, void spaces, and things like that, these are all things that you have to take into account in doing this. As Wes said in his area, they've got SOPs for them, and they work great. We don't have, if we started pressurizing places at the first floor with the fire on the second floor, and we have people living on the third, fourth, and fifth floor, we might be pushing the products of combustion to the spaces above the fire area and harming more people. So everything, like everything that we've talked about today, it all goes back to SOPs, or as we're now calling them, SOGs. It comes back to what your plan is at this fire, what your plan is for attack, and is everybody on the same page with that plan, and are we following it and making sure that we're making our people safe? And again, we've all seen pictures of it going wrong, and it has gone wrong. We've also, if you pay attention, you've seen pictures and success stories. It does go right. It's not an end-all, save-all, or anything else, as Wes said. It's a tool. It's something that you can use. It's something to have in the box, but it's just one of many, many things. There are many, many ways to fight a fire. No one's going to say that what New York City does is always right or what anybody else does is always wrong. It's not. It's what works for your department and for us with our buildings, their size, age, shape, and the amount of renovation and construction in these buildings. Positive pressure ventilation does not work very, very well for us.
Okay, and we'll finish up with Rod Ford from Glenwood.
Out here in my department, we don't use positive pressure ventilation just because we don't have any experience with it and we don't have any training with it. Our ventilation initially is limited to vertical ventilation, opening up the roof, skylights, scuttles, and our horizontal ventilation in coordination with the first attack line. We do, however, once the fire is knocked down and we're in the overhaul process, we'll set up a fan at the front door and try to push in fresh air and blow out the smoke. But that's only after the fire has been knocked down and we've opened up a little bit and we're confident that the fire hasn't made its way into any void spaces. So it's really just an afterthought with the overhauling process. But it's something that we definitely have some interest in, and you know, we were definitely looking to learn a little bit more about, especially with our limited manpower. So you know, it's nice to listen in and learn a little bit about it.
Okay, we'll finish up. If anybody has anything else, any comments, anything that you may have wanted to say earlier, or something that's come up since then, anybody have any last words for the show?
I would love to say one last thing, if I may, Pete. I think all of us who spoke today would agree on one thing. It's about training, okay? It's about being alert, learning, and still learning. I've been doing firefighting, starting as a volunteer, since 1973. Yes, I am an old man, and I still learn every day. When I go to the firehouse, there's always something I could do different, something I could do better, and I learn at every fire I go to, and I keep learning. If you stop learning in the fire service, get out, because you're going to kill yourself or someone else.
Very good words, Mike. Very true. Anything else from anybody?
No, I agree with Mike on that, and I think that goes back to a point that he made before: the officer sets the tone. And if we're going to teach the people that are replacing us the craft of firefighting and the ethic of, you know, always providing the best job you can with what you have, then the officer definitely has to set a tone. And by showing that you're learning still, no matter how long you've been there, that does promote the craftsmanship of firefighting. I think that's very important nowadays.
I very much like what Wes said about the craftsmanship. I think people bandy about the term the art of firefighting, but I think it's very true. You know, and pay status has obviously got nothing to do with it. All you have to do is check the wall in Emmitsburg for that. But I think the training the people, I'm very pro-standardization. You know, if you sit in this seat, this is what you're going to pick up at this dwelling, this is what you're going to pick up at that dwelling. The SOPs have got to be in place. You don't see a football team going out on the field and just, you know, sandlotting it, drawing something in the dirt. They go out, there's a set of plays, they know what they're doing before they get out there. I think it's no different from the fire service. You know, the military's the same way. But, yeah, it's been really great to listen to these three gentlemen and their contributions to all of this.
Dave, I just have one other thing to say. I thought my Jets were drawing the stuff in the sand because they haven't been doing very good otherwise.
right, guys. Again, well, thank you very much for joining us. We have today Mike Dugan, captain with Letter 123 in FDNY, Rod Ford, a volunteer firefighter with the Glenwood Fire Company in New York, Dave Gallagher, a retired lieutenant with Huber Heights, Ohio Fire Department, and Wes Kitchell, a captain with Santa Rosa, California. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for listening as well. If you do have any comments or questions for upcoming shows, please let us know. You can send us an email to podcast@firehouse.com. Thank you very much, and we hope to have everybody back real soon here on Radio at Firehouse.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.